Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lau. Lyle.
Did you say Lyle again?
No, I think it's Lyle.
Well, you know what? It was better than Bane showing up again, so.
Oh, I'm not quite done my water.
I didn't bring my glass.
So the three of us sat down to play Game of Thrones Melee.
Yeah, game was a lot easier than I expected.
A lot harder than I expected because there's only Joust. Well, also says the man who won.
Yeah. Nice. I guess when somebody makes the deck for you and tells you what to do every step of the way, then yeah, the game's pretty easy.
You gotta give a little credit. He didn't tell him what to do every step of the way. I mean, that last turn, you were giving him some pretty bad advice, seeing how he was going to beat you. And me too, I guess.
Yeah, this is pretty funny. I had this one card called Valar Morghulis that kind of basically clears everything off the board, which included both of Wayne and Lyle's combos. So, yeah, Lyle said, you know, there's the advice you get before you use that card and the advice you'd get afterwards. And,
advice you get after using that card is none.
Yeah.
F off. Yeah. F off. Yeah. Play your own card.
Yeah. I don't know what that does. Figure it out on your own.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a lot of fun. It was a pretty complicated game. I suppose we're planning on doing a cast on reviewing it properly, so I'll maybe save all the details for it then. But yeah, I liked it a lot.
Yeah, Lyle and I have been playing Joust at lunch, which is the two-player game. And the Melee game, which is the multiplayer game, introduces more elements, including like a board and titles or positions you take that have an effect in the game. So yeah, there's a lot of components and a lot of decisions you have to make.
Yeah, there are.
We were playing at a cafe at Osaka's busiest train station. So there was a lot of people walking by.
Yep.
And giving us the double take. And it could have been the board and the cards in our hand, or it could have just been us.
I think it was just us.
We were just getting a lot of looks.
Yeah. Most of them were kind of more curiosity than otherwise, but there were a couple who giggled on the way past. So I held eye contact. Slowly licked my teeth.
Yeah, so we're not really here to talk about Game of Thrones, though. As Chris said, we'll talk about that in a future episode, along with Netrunner and another card game. We're here to talk about the big news, which is the release of D&D 5th Edition. And as most people are aware, they uploaded the basic rules on their website, and you can download them for free.
I think the upload went up July 4th, Japan time, although I think it was still the 3rd back in the States.
And I think 6 hours later, somebody was posting, I've already started to house rule them.
Six hours, probably like 6 minutes.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, well done. Like, what are you supposed to say to that? But it's presented as like, I'm a mad genius. I've already found the flaws, and I'm fixing it with my house rules. That just reminded me of Wile E. Coyote. You know,
and all his house ruled games?
Exactly.
Really, he just wanted to catch the Roadrunner to play D&D.
Yeah. No, you haven't seen the episode or the cartoon with Bugs Bunny, and he talks?
Oh, yeah.
No, I don't think I have.
And he's making some bomb, and... Well, he has his card printed, Wile E. Coyote, genius. And while he's hatching this plan, he's thinking how he's going to change his card to Super Genius. He's like, well, E. Coyote, Super Genius. Oh, of course, a train runs him over. Or you just imagine somebody with the basic rules going, oh, I'm going to change this. Oh, that's Super Genius. These are like super house rules.
Jeez, I can only imagine what those would be like.
What we're going to do today is do a read review. So unlike our campaign confession episode where we play a campaign and then give our thoughts on the system, this is where we read through the rule book and we give our thoughts on the system. When we do a review, we like to do a baseline just so people know where we're coming from. So this review's baseline is, what makes D&D D&D to you?
Well, for me, it's kind of all the Tolkien tropes and that kind of basic D20 system. Yeah, that's really kind of the central thing for it for me. There's elves and dwarves, magical weapons, those kinds of things, and then you use a d20 for it.
Okay, yeah, I was thinking it's the Tolkien-esque fantasy, which I guess has kind of become the generic fantasy world. Mm-hmm. Yeah, with elves and dwarves and orcs and goblins and kind of the, I guess there are some classic D&D monsters, and like, you know, beholders and the Tarrasque. The kind of the idea that magic weapons or magic items are supposed to be rare, but actually quite common. And the Vanthian magic system, kind of the fire and forget, is D&D to me, which I know we're not talking about 4th edition, but that's kind of why I had, not trouble, but that's kind of why 4th edition didn't feel like D&D to me. The powers were just a bit too much of a departure from what I considered to be Dungeons & Dragons.
D&D for me is slick art, especially on the covers. Mm-hmm. And I think this goes back to probably 2nd edition, where you'd walk into the comic book store, the game store, and you saw some really nice-looking covers, and then you're like, oh, it's Forgotten Realms, though. Yeah.
Ouch. Thought you were going to be positive here.
No, I was a Greyhawk guy. So. And, of course, levels. And I guess games focus on progression. Hmm. You know, getting to the next level, going through a series of challenges or tasks or encounters. Yeah, yeah, that's kind of the iconic character roles. Hmm. Fighter, wizard, cleric, rogue. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to add all of those to my list, too.
Okay.
Yeah. So what makes D&D? Yeah, I guess the stuff that's kind of carried through every edition.
Right.
And I'm glad Wayne did bring up about 4th edition. We are going to make reference to the other editions because it's a little impossible not to, considering that's why we've got a 5th edition and what happened with 4th. But we're not necessarily going to do a comparison as like what's been the best edition overall. And
right.
And
because only that way lies trolls.
Anyway lies trolls.
True enough.
Now, it's a free product, so it's accessible to anybody. So why are we reviewing a free game? Because, hey, it's free.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. And it's like when Skype cuts out and you start cursing it and, hey, it's free.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure, Facebook's stealing all your personal information. It's free.
And affecting your mood. But, hey, it's free. Yeah.
Yeah, and also, it's D&D, you know, that's kind of the granddaddy, the big name in role-playing, too. It's the same reason that other countries cover the U.S. presidential election. Because we're the best. No laughs.
Oh, okay. I get how you connected that.
Other than it's simply happening?
Yeah, it's very topical. People are talking about it.
Right.
And as Chris said, this is the first and biggest RPG.
Actually, I was initially going to disagree with Chris's analogy, but I can see it now because, you know, D&D is kind of an indicator, or at least in my opinion, an indicator of the health of the role-playing game hobby as a whole. And everyone, a lot of people, are waiting to see how this edition does and waiting to see what effect it will have on the hobby as a whole. So
yeah.
I was initially skeptical of that analogy, but now I think it's kind of apt. So yeah.
I mean, whether it's true or not, it's the name in role playing for
right.
Non-gamers. Dungeons and Dragons is synonymous with RPGs. So.
Right. That I think I said exactly the same thing to Lyle today. You know, at work, where you know, for better or worse, people who don't know the hobby probably use D&D and role playing games interchangeably.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is something that we like to talk about quite a bit in our episodes: is reaching new gamers or old gamers, and expanding the hobby. So like Wayne said, this is a barometer as to the hobby's health. But with this basic D&D, who is it for? Now, the starter set is obviously for the new player. And it's certainly priced that way. It's very, very attractive price.
Right.
But this basic D&D that's up on their website for free, a lot of people are saying, hey, this is great for the new player. Because they can access it with no entry costs.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think? Do you really think this is for the new player?
No, I don't. I think this is for people like us who, you know, pretty much know what role-playing games are and are curious about what the new edition of D&D is going to look like, but don't want to put up a blind investment or wait for the player's handbook. especially for us since we're on the other side of the world, and who knows what shipping would cost. So I would disagree with anyone who says that this D&D basic is for the absolutely new person.
Yeah, it ticks the boxes for it. It has the section that explains what the dice are and what, you know, D6 means and what role-playing is. But it's written as if it assumes a lot of knowledge about the, not just D&D specifically, but about gaming in general. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm of the same mind. I think it's for existing players or, for people who have left D&D or haven't traded up to any of the editions. Maybe they lost them at third, maybe they lost them at second or first mm-hmm. even. So it's for those people.
Yeah.
So I found it a little bit curious why they did have about five pages for that, it, you know, explained what role playing is, what like specific versus general rules are, like where characters have specific rules that might override the general rules.
Right.
But I suppose you need to put that in just in case somebody were to download 110 pages without pictures and plow through those. Right. And the reason why we're talking about this is something that I saw on a site where somebody thought this was great that now they had something that they could hand to a new player.
Right.
And I thought that I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't hand a new person 110 pages, absent pictures. You know, it's free, okay, so we didn't get any pictures. Yeah, I'm only mildly complaining about that. But, I mean, there are better things to hand a new person than basic D&D.
Right. No, I completely agree, and that's why I said I don't think it's for absolutely new players. The part about the introduction, how to use these rules, how to play, how to read the game dice, that think about specific beats general and kind of what you generally do, is just in case somebody does get handed this, you know, and because they're a new player and say, here, read this, or someone does just stumble across it. So they have to hedge their bets, and I understand.
How are they going to find this?
Well, I mean,
like somebody's going to walk by them on the street and hand them these pages, and it's like, what is this?
It's not a chick track or a watchtower, all right? But
have you considered D&D?
Yeah, have you considered D&D?
Knock on the door.
But actually, you mentioning that, I didn't really think of it, but D&D.
We could be stuffing it into mailboxes.
We could. You're right. 110 pages, it wouldn't fit in any of them. But D&D is more than just the role-playing game now. It's novels, it's board games, it's, you know, cell phone app games. And so there's a chance someone might have visited the website because of those other things and finally say, okay, let's see what the role-playing game is. Or, you know, Hasbro or Wizards of the Coast also has other product lines, Magic being a big one. And so they might get some bleed over there.
One of the things that's really caught people's attention with these rules and it's getting a lot of traffic online is the section on personality and background, and in particular sex. And people are by and large praising how inclusive the wording is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just read it just in case people haven't read it themselves. And it says, you don't need to be confined to binary notions of sex and gender. The elf god Corellians is often seen as androgynous and hermaphroditic, for example, and some elves in the multiverse are made in Corellian's image. You can also play a female character who presents herself as a man who feels trapped in a female body, or a bearded female dwarf who hates being mistaken for a male. Likewise, your character's sexual orientation is for you to decide. And to be clear, that was a bearded female dwarf, not a beaded female dwarf.
Right.
Though you can play that too if you want. There's no problems with that.
Right. I wonder what that would look like. But
lots of beads.
Yeah. Obviously.
I tell you, when I was in the make-your-own jewelry shop and one of the...
You accidentally made a beard.
No, he actually made a dwarf out of beads.
Yeah, I was like maybe one of two guys in that whole store. And it was packed. Making your own jewelry has really taken off as a hobby in Japan.
Hmm. Yeah. That's
Were you trying to get a date?
I was there with my wife, so...
Oh, guess not.
Maybe. So
we were trying to get a date.
Oh. But
Yeah, but back on topic. Yeah, more power to him. This is fantastic. You know, I think there was a lot of controversy over that first image that was released. That was all everyone when the picture was white, but they seem to have really gone out of their way to be inclusive in this. And I suppose there has been trolling, as Wayne pointed out. There's trolling on anything you do, but yeah, great, good job, guys.
I've heard people complain about the wording. I don't know exactly what they were complaining about, but I think it's a step in the right direction. And maybe I'm stepping on Lyle's point here, but something Wizards could have done is, on the one hand, I'm happy they are that explicit and that specific, but on the other hand, being that explicit and that specific, leaves the door open for people to complain on both sides of the issue. On the one hand, people complaining that they don't want that in their game, but you writing it down, for whatever reason, they feel they have to include it now because it's written down. Or the other side is, that was great, but you don't go far enough. And we would have liked to see you do more. Maybe what Wizards just should have done is, make a fairly small section of simply, you don't need to be confined to binary notions of sex and gender. And your character's sexual orientation is for you to decide. You know, just leave it general like that. Fair enough. Trolls are everywhere, and maybe people would say that doesn't go far enough, but I think you could
have
just...
But they said that anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So yeah. You're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. But I don't know. Maybe in this case, general would have been better than specifics.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly didn't need to go... I mean, this is quite a leap. I don't think sexual orientation has been really... hasn't been explicitly mentioned in the game. I mean, there's never been a place on your character sheet to write down heterosexual. Or it's never already been printed on that you're heterosexual.
Right.
Because, hey, you just are. They could have just done something general. They decided to go a little bit more explicit. I'm fine with that. But yeah, it does annoy me, the people that give the damn them with faint praise and will say, oh, it's a nice start. It's not perfect. The wording's not perfect. And then I would just say, well, okay, show me some perfect wording. Show me how you would have written it. And I think at least one person has actually said, I would have written it this way. And I'm fine with that because at least they're putting it out there what they think would have been more acceptable wording. But for the people that are just going to say, well, the wording's not perfect, but I think it's great that they did it. I don't care what you say. And I don't care about your opinion.
Yeah.
Write out why it's not perfect. Right. It's not like a movie where you could say, well, the movie has flaws, but I liked it, because somebody's not going to refilm the movie. But this is a paragraph, so I think that person on the internet can then write out the paragraph that they think would be perfect wording here.
Good point. Yeah, I think I saw the at least one person, as you said, Lyle, who said, you know, I would have preferred to see it written this way. And I'm pretty sure the person who wrote that was transgender. Part of the reason why I'm not going to say whether it goes too far or isn't perfect, because I'm not transgender, and so I don't know, or I feel I don't know, what is acceptable terminology or what is acceptable language or not. So that's why I'm only kind of comfortable saying put it in general. Or if you're going to write something like that, that's that specific, get someone who is transgender to at least consult on what you're doing to make sure, you know?
Yeah, but we don't know that they didn't. And one transgender person doesn't speak for all transgender people.
That's very true.
So, yeah. Anyway, yeah, I think it's fine. I think by and large, most people will be fine with this. And people that, and by and large, for the people that aren't fine with it, they'll get over it, and they'll still like the game if they were going to like the game anyway, and they'll just ignore that paragraph.
Right.
And for the people that, you know, are saying things like it's not perfect, then yeah, put up or shut up.
Yeah, they did well in the character creation as well. They have more skin tone variation in the races than they have.
We
in
talked about
editions.
That when we saw the first picture,
mm-hmm.
and saying, yeah, why not and make the skin tones more varied for the demi-humans?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Why just confine it to the humans that they're all shades, but the other ones are not more restricted? I think the elves in particular It says that they are as many shades as humans.
Yeah.
I was pretty pleased to see that, because that is a big change from what was in the playtest packets up to the last packet. The last packet said that elves are generally very fair or pale-skinned. Right. And so, yeah, I was very happy to see that they said, no, elves can be pretty much run the entire range of skin tones, just as humans, as well as have, you know, kind of non-human skin tones, copper, bronze, maybe bluish, which then, and they also did widen the skin tone variations for dwarves and halflings then.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of wondering, like, if you said, hey, elves can be pretty much the entire range of human skin tones and these other ones, why not do that for dwarves and halflings as well? Why not say dwarves could run the entire range of human, you know, and are also these ones that are just, like, I understand you want the demi-human races to be distinct, and so don't make the skin tones overlap, you know, say, like, I don't know, elves could be, you know, bluish or copperish, where dwarves could be, I don't know, you know, reddish or whatever, and then gnomes could be something else. I mean, I know there's only so many colors, but
I get a feeling that it's just a matter of keeping the writing from being the same in each paragraph, because the way they describe the dwarves, they say it specifically, but they give them all the same ranges as humans, from deep brown to a paler hue, sometimes tinged with red, shades of light brown, deep tan, etc.
Right, but I think humans actually go wider than that.
Okay.
Human skin tones range from nearly black to very pale. And I understand you don't want to write the same thing for, you know, every race, because you want it to be distinct. But
well, the dwarves can be deep brown to what they say, a paler hue tinged with red.
Right.
So I think they're saying you don't really have
dwarves. Yeah, you're going to be mostly brown, yeah.
Yeah, so obviously albinos are not going to be terribly happy with this description.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, my theory about why... although I agree with Chris, it is to give them some distinction between the races that they have.
Mm-hmm.
But another is, if you have the jet black drow for the elves, you can't really go, oh, elves are all pale. Except for the black ones over there. Now those guys are bad.
Yeah, right, they're evil.
In fact, the darker an elf gets, the more prone to crime. It's like, where are you going with this, D&D?
Right.
So I think because they had the drows, and they certainly weren't going to get rid of the drows, that they needed to have dark elves that were okay and not just like drits.
Right.
So they needed to have dark elves, not necessarily drows, but darker colored elves that perhaps look like they're from Africa or Somalia or Ethiopia. And they're great and they're really nice. And they don't have slavery and things like that. You know, they needed like a nice dark elf.
Right, right. Well, I know we're not going to compare editions or games, but
this is the third time
I've
done it.
I know. All right, me. This is all me. The drow are part of D&D. It's kind of, again, damned if you do, damned if you don't. If they just dropped the drow, how many people would complain? You know, you're getting
a
rid
lot.
Of that. Exactly, a lot. I think 13th Age kind of did it. They don't have the baggage of D&D, right? Because they're not doing the D&D multiverse now. But I think 13th Age is a little better, where they're just like, drow aren't evil. They're just kind of cruel. And their society is kind of cruel. Which, you know, has its own problems. But it's better than saying, yeah, these guys over here with the black skin, they're all bad. So...
Yeah, but if you're taking a traditional bent, you could argue the same thing, you know, that elves have always been pale-skinned from Tolkien onward.
Ah, yeah, but not from the Norse onward. Didn't they have, like, dark elves?
Did they? I'm unaware.
Yeah, the light and dark elves. But, I mean, if you go back to, like, Norse, you know, mythology, dwarf and elf is... They blend together a lot.
Yeah, it's true. If you go to, like, England and stuff like that, the fairy, there's the Unseelie Fae and the Seelie Fae and all that.
Well, I was just thinking, like, you know, Norse, I mean, like, you might not have those distinct dwarf and elf races if you're basing it on Norse mythology.
Yeah.
But anyway, that may be a topic for another time.
Yeah, tangent.
Right. But for the most part, I think they're doing a decent job of being inclusive, despite that initial picture I complained about. Looking forward to seeing what's in the player's handbook and hoping that they keep that diversity.
Yeah, and they're definitely putting in the effort, so I applaud them for that.
So we're going to split up how we review D&D Basic into two broad categories. One will be the rules, and one will be style. And since we've been talking about characters so much, so let's start with character creation.
I mean, I think this is going to be a reoccurring statement throughout this whole section, but it's pretty much the same as D&D has always been. They have the same basic races, though it's a slimmed down list. It doesn't include gnome or half-orc or anything like that.
Not a problem for me.
True. Humans, dwarves, halflings, and elves. It goes into the classes as well. It takes kind of the primary classes, cleric, fighter, rogue, and wizard, and goes through all of them. One of the new things that they have for character creation is each class kind of has a specialization, or what was it called?
It's called different things for different groups. Okay. So like the cleric has their domain, the fighter has their martial archetype, the rogue has a roguish archetype, and the wizard, as you can imagine, has an arcane tradition, which is kind of the schools of magic we're familiar with.
Which is interesting. You get to pick those right away from first level, so you can kind of, it's a nice way to tailor your character for it. Though in this book, they only give one sample for each, and they say that if you want more, you should go and buy the player's handbook. So business is business.
Right. And again, I don't really have a problem with that. They probably chose the classic subclass. Oh, that sounds awkward. The classic subclass, you know, for each of the classes, you know, the cleric that heals, the rogue that is a thief and good at disarming traps and stealing things, the fighter that kind of focuses on melee combat, the wizard was a little bit harder because we're the schools of magic really all that distinct? Not really, in my opinion, except maybe for illusion, but yeah. So it's not incredibly new because second edition had the specializations or, you know, things similar to it, and, you know, third edition had that as well. I think only kind of like fourth edition. Oh, no, the fourth edition had builds. So
it's a variation of that. It's a, yeah.
One of the things that has changed, and it's kind of going back a little bit to 3.5, to where you have a level bonus, which is kind of your generalized bonus to your skills and attacks and things like that. But they've changed it here to a proficiency bonus.
Hmm.
And they've kind of tied that into the actual proficiencies, whereas in previous editions you would get a negative or a bonus based on whether or not you're proficient in, say, a weapon or a skill. But now this is all tied together into just a generalized number that you get for everything. And it's just a matter of if you are proficient in a skill, a saving throw, a weapon, a spell casting, a tool, all the different categories. And if so, you get to add this bonus to it, and if not, then you don't.
Right.
So it's it's really slimming down the rules and the bonus structure, and I really like that.
Well, I didn't think about it until you brought it up, Chris, and I didn't go through the document with a fine-tooth comb, but it doesn't look like there are any negative modifiers.
No.
So
for your abilities as well, like instead of the older version of if you get a bonus to this, you get a negative to that.
Right.
And here you, hey, it's just all bonus.
Right, all bonus all the time. But
no, so you pick your main one. So for example, halfling, you'll get +2 to your dex. And then you pick what kind of halfling you are, lightfoot or stout.
Mm-hmm.
And that will either give you a bonus to your charisma or your bonus to your constitution.
Right. Mm-hmm. If you're a human, you get +1 in everything.
I thought that was a mistake.
Nope.
Yeah.
When I saw the sample at the beginning, I'm like, oh, they're getting +1 to everything? Or did they just forget to say choose 2 or choose 3? And then, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Great to be human.
Are awesome.
Yeah, this was a tangent to what I was going to say, but I guess it's difficult to make humans interesting in D&D because they always seem to get the, hey, you get a bonus feat of your choice, or hey, you get +2 to an ability score of your choice, or in this case, hey, you get +1 to everything because why the heck not? You're a human, and we got to make them attractive somehow, mechanically, to play.
Yeah, not to dump on them. That definitely makes them attractive to play, but it doesn't really make them interesting, in my opinion.
Fair enough, I would agree.
The self-loathing that's going on here.
Anyway, back
to... I could be a dwarf.
I pick a human all the time.
Yeah, exactly, because of that mechanical bonus.
I'd be like, another feat? Wow. Because that was just something... for me, it was a choice. Here, +1 to everything, I don't really get a choice, but when one of the editions introduced that... I thought that was great. I thought that was a really good addition, or a really good addition,
mm-hmm.
in that it was giving me an extra choice for playing a human. it was like an opportunity to make my character a little bit more individual.
Mm-hmm. And it's definitely something I think that really made humans attractive in that section.
And I don't hate my race either.
So. Right, because you had a choice in that too.
I guess I don't hate my species.
Yes, species. Mm-hmm. But not even species if they can all interbreed. But anyway, that's another tangent. But back to the thing Chris was saying about proficiency.
I see what they should have included in the inclusiveness thing.
All right. But at first I wasn't all that keen on them lumping everything into a proficiency bonus. But it makes sense, and now I quite like it, because saying you are proficient with fill in the blank here allows them to do a lot of stuff. So far we see that in saving throws, with tools, with weapons, with skills,
armor, everything.
So yeah, them making it all just one bonus that scales by level makes it simpler, easier, because you don't have to remember a bunch of numbers or you don't get confused by all these other things that you have proficiencies in. Now it's just, are you proficient in that? Yes. Okay, then you get this bonus when you are using that ability or check or skill.
And another cool point is that the proficiency scales for all the different classes at the same rate. You get four levels of +2, four levels of +3, four levels of +4, etc., which means that it's really easy now to do the multi-class thing in a very similar manner to 3.5, and it doesn't matter what classes you've taken, your proficiency bonus is always going to be the same. You don't have to worry about any extra math there.
Well, I mean, they do have bonuses for things. In addition to the proficiency, I do like the proficiency. I think it's great. But if you take a fighting style, such as archery, you're going to get a +2 bonus to attack rolls you make with ranged weapons.
Right.
So that's an additional bonus.
They've also kind of included a new step. It was introduced in later seasons of 4th edition, and that's adding in, well, they call it personalizing your character, which is adding in traits, bonds, flaws, backgrounds, and things of the sort, kind of role-playing elements that also grant bonuses.
Yeah, giving characters a background isn't anything new. But yeah, as you mentioned, the personality traits, ideals, and flaws are new-ish in a sense that now they have mechanical teeth, which I think this is the first time we're really seeing that in any edition of D&D. Usually it's just, you can, you know, personalize your character however you want, give him like a cool scar or a limp or something, and roleplay your character to make him distinct. But we never really had mechanics come into that at all. Now mechanics do come into that with something called inspiration. And it says, you know, you gain inspiration by playing out your personality traits, giving in to the drawbacks presented by a flaw or a bond, or otherwise portraying your character in a compelling way. Yeah. So while ideals, flaws, and bonds give you, you know, kind of cues as to how to roleplay your character, now you get something for doing so.
Mm-hmm. They're not too dissimilar from aspects in other games like Fate, where you get to write out whatever you like. The example they give in here is, I've read every book in Candlekeep, is one of their personality traits. Ideals, then, are kind of things that your character strives for. Bond is kind of your connections to other people and the world. And then flaws, obviously, are character flaws.
Mechanically, I'm going to disagree that they're like aspects, because aspects are very double-edged. They can be used positively or negatively, so that you can either invoke them for, a bonus, or they get compelled, and then you get a reward for stinking now but being better later on. Where here, they're very much broken up into, you know, your ideals and your personality traits are largely positive, while your flaw is, almost always negative, hence it being called a flaw.
Yeah. So. That's a good point. Sorry, I meant as in that you're free to just kind of write out whatever you like.
Yeah, in that respect, totally. You know, it's kind of like, you know, aspects in Fate, or distinctions in Cortex Plus, or even backgrounds in 13th Age, where you can pretty much write anything you want.
Or even like your one unique thing in 13th Age.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe more.
And the inspiration is like Benny's from Savage Worlds, and
that's the first thing I saw when I read the mechanics first.
And from Oh, Hollow Earth Expedition.
Style points.
Yeah, style points. Yeah. Again, it's kind of like the inclusive thing. I like that they're trying something new. It's great. I've seen it done better, but hey.
I certainly don't mind it. I do like that they tied them up to the backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you have an acolyte, then you look to the right of that, and then you've got 8 personality traits, 6 ideals, 6 bonds, 6 flaws. So even if you really like the randomness of like old school D&D, you just roll on these tables.
Right.
And it gives you your personality, gives you your ideal, gives you your bond, gives you your flaw. Some of these people had trouble when they were reading it, looking at other reviews. Like say, for example, bond, exactly how that would work within the game and how they should phrase it. So, I mean, it's certainly good to have these tables to give them examples. Mm-hmm. Of what is a bond. So even if you don't want to roll, it's good to just look at these tables and kind of work from there. And okay, now I understand. So a bond here, I will someday get revenge on the corrupt temple hierarchy, rent me a heretic. Okay, I don't want to do that. I don't want to, none of these appeal to me, but I thought of one that I could do.
No, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought of them providing, them working as examples. But as you said, the background tables can be used for someone who is drawing a blank and doesn't know what to make their character like, and then, hey, let's just roll some dice and build something out of what we get. Or it could be, I don't know what to write for these, you know, personality traits, ideals, bonds, and flaws, so let's look at these for example. Oh, that one's really cool. Or as Lyle said, you know, none of these are fitting, but now I have an idea of what I should write in there or what would make a good one.
Yeah, you can roll up something right and quick for a quick session, or you could even play it like a Traveler game where you kind of build your character randomly. Yeah. Before we get too far into it, one of the things that Lyle mentioned, the backgrounds. The backgrounds are an additional mechanic that's worked the same way that they did in 4E, which is you choose a background, for example, acolyte or criminal or a folk hero or something like that. This background gives you some additional proficiencies and some additional languages, and a really cool part of it, I thought, was some additional equipment. Of course, there are also the personality traits, ideal, bonds, and flaw tables listed to the side that you can roll on.
Well, for me, more exciting than the extra proficiencies, language, and equipment, which, yeah, are kind of similar to what you got in a class package with 4E. All of the backgrounds have some little narrative hook that kind of can't be represented by a numerical bonus. So, for example, like Acolyte, you know, their feature is Shelter of the Faithful. And it says, you command the respect of those who share your faith. You can perform religious ceremonies of your deity. You can expect to receive free healing and care at a temple, shrine, or other established presence of your faith. That can't be summed up in a number. All of the backgrounds have some little thing like that where it's a bonus that's not just numerical. I like that.
Yeah, they certainly add a nice feature in the feature. If you had a rule that would encourage people to roleplay, I think even more so than perhaps the personality trait ideal in that, it might even be the feature, because the acolyte one is about just getting help from temples. The folk hero, which I think is a really nice background, has rustic hospitality, so you blend in well with other commoners.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, that's a good point.
And they could hide you if you were on the run. So you automatically think of a lot of classic stories that are associated with that. And I think the feature, more so than maybe anything here, will really help a new player to kind of latch on to or connect the background to some work of fiction that they're familiar with.
Right, right.
So,
no, that's really good. I guess just on the skill thing, I think it's worth pointing out that you get skill proficiencies for the background and I think class. So that you still, as far as I know, I think you still have a skill rating in that. You're just, so it just allows you to do these things a little bit better. So it's...
Yeah, you can default to your ability.
Right.
But this gives you a bonus. And that's something, well, this will be my first time breaking the addition rule that we had, and certainly something that I liked about 4E. And it's perhaps my favorite thing about 4E is how they streamline the skills. And you didn't have to do the ranks. You just, if you were proficient in this skill, you got like +5.
Yeah, I think you were untrained or trained.
Trained, there you go.
Now, I just realized that, kind of unlike 4E, where I don't think you got better at a skill except for when your attribute bonus increased, or you wasted a feat slot on being trained in an additional skill, here, because the proficiency bonus scales with level, they've kind of gotten the skill points from 3E without the bookkeeping of the points. You're proficient in, you know, I don't know, riding or whatever. Great, when you hit 5th level, your proficiency bonus is now 3. You're better at the skills that you are proficient with, and that continues all the way up to 20th level. So I hadn't realized that until just now.
Yeah, actually, talking about skills, that's, I think, one of the only criticisms that I had of the new system. And it might be something that I'm just not understanding right, and will get sorted out in when we give it a playtest. But it's the way that skills are rolled in-game. And basically, the way that D&D has always been is you have your list of skills. If you do an action with the skill, you use that skill bonus. And if you do an action that doesn't specifically align to a skill, you kind of choose whatever is the closest skill, or just kind of fit it in wherever it might work. But now the skill list is really short. There's not that many skills in it, and everything defaults to your ability bonus, which in the case of these proficiencies, you know, we're talking can be, you know, something like +4, +5, +6 points difference when you're testing them out. And I think that the limitation of the amount of skills with the additional rule that you go back to the ability, you default back to the ability score when you don't have a skill, it seems like you can get a lot of variation in your actual abilities. And because there's not that many skills, it seems to be pretty limiting as to what you're allowed to specialize in. For example, you can do stealth and you can do trap checking now, but there's no use rope. So that means, theoretically, I'm not able to specialize in tying knots, even though that's something that realistically I would be able to. Another thing, one I think was string instruments, which are now under the dexterity ability, but there is no perform in the dexterity list. So you can't learn a guitar.
Well, you can. You just don't get a bonus. You don't get your proficiency bonus for it.
Right. So you don't have that skill. You only have your natural ability for it.
Right.
And, of course, the game is open enough, and they say that you can make up stuff here and there, but it's kind of the way that it's set up, it does seem a little bit limiting.
I don't know. Like, as you said, you can always make up a skill. So, like, if you were playing a bard, which isn't in the basic packet, but by the way, and you said, instead of this skill that I get for my class or background, whatever, can I have stringed instruments instead? I think any reasonable GM would say, sure. And now you get your proficiency bonus for that. But I don't, I don't see it. I mean, I know they're different systems, but I don't see defaulting to your ability score all that different from something in, say, like White Wolf, where you're rolling extra dice when you have dots in that skill, but if you don't, you just default to whatever your attribute would be.
Yeah, but White Wolf, or World of Darkness, has a lot of skills, and you have access to a lot of them.
Yeah. So despite that, though, they do mention it earlier on that you can mix and match your ability checks. I think the example they give is where somebody swimming might use their constitution rather than their strength for an athletics skill check. I think that's really neat because that's something that other games, specifically White Wolf, have allowed you to do. That's a really great addition. So I'm glad to see it added to D&D.
Yeah. In this case, it being D&D, I think people are expecting skills to work a certain way. And so, yeah, the Wizards of the Coast doesn't have as open a field to play around with skills as other games. So I think them saying, hey, these skills map to these, you know, ability scores. We're kind of compacting the skill list, but you can mix and match if you want, is kind of, you know, splitting the difference and kind of getting the best of both worlds there.
Yeah. So get into gameplay. A lot of it falls under combat, but not exclusively. One thing that appeared quite early in the playtest, and obviously it must have gotten favorable enough reviews that it's now in here, and that is advantage and disadvantage.
Yeah.
And advantage means that you roll 2d20 and you choose the highest, and if you have a disadvantage in something, then you roll 2d20 and you choose the lowest. Other things would be that's in here as initiative, which would as you would expect. Really, the order of combat is, it wouldn't be too surprising to anybody. You determine if there's a surprise, you establish where people are. It seems to be encouraging more theater of the mind than a grid.
Mm-hmm.
Then you roll initiative, then you take turns, and then you begin the next round. You still roll a d20 against some sort of target number,
right.
And if you exceed it, then you succeed.
And if you fail, you fail. Revolutionary!
And, yeah, I mean, you still have hit points, hit dice. Damage is determined often by what it says on your spell or what it says on your weapon. Running is now dashing, so it just doubles your speed.
Right.
They still have attacks of opportunity. They've tried to simplify it, so they have an action called disengage. So if you take the disengage action, then your movement away doesn't provoke an attack of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You've got dodge as an action. You have push, no shove, which would be as you would expect. And it's similar to something called bull rush that we might have seen in previous editions, but probably a little bit clearer, just calling it shove.
Right.
Yeah,
I can kind of see why a lot of people are saying that these rules have been kind of cleaned up and simplified and streamlined reading this. Now on your turn, you can always move and take one action. There's no more, move, minor, standard action.
Right, trading them around and all that good stuff.
Yeah, none of that. Although the movement was a little complicated. In that you can split up your movement, you can break it up between attacks, but only if you meet certain criteria. But by and large, it's, as Lyle said, as you would expect if you are familiar with any, kind of previous versions of Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, and since you mentioned that, it's not necessarily something that's consistent in all versions of or all editions of Dungeons & Dragons, but most of the things in the entire rule set, you'll go, oh, I recognize that from da-da-da.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it's just, it's a true combination of all the additions. When you drop to 0 hit points, you either die outright or fall unconscious.
And it looked pretty hard to die outright.
Yeah.
You have to get to negative your hit points?
In a single hit.
Yeah.
In a single hit. Massive damage.
I like that. It was frustrating when somebody took like a tree trunk from a giant and then dusted themselves off and then threw themselves back into the battle. It'd be nice to see that person turn into some red pudding or something.
Hey, sorry, that's not D&D. Really, because massive damage didn't... I mean, it might do it sometimes, but if the person is even like one hit point away from that negative maximum, they're still at 0, and the cleric is just going to go cure light wounds, and hey, they're back to full fighting effectiveness. So
don't be so cynical.
Hey, have you met me before?
Yeah. Then you have death saving throws, which it's actually on the character sheet. How fun would that be? You've got the 3 dots of succeed and the 3 dots of fail. So it's you roll 10 or higher and you succeed. And if you don't, then you fail. And it's whether or not you get 3 successes or 3 failures.
Right.
Determines whether or not you die. Mm-hmm. And, you can mark the space on your character sheet. So I can imagine, as everybody else is having fun, for that 1 second that it's your turn, you roll the dice and then...
All right, Bob, your turn.
I fill out this dot. I'm going to really, take my time filling this dot out.
Hey, Bob, why does your character sheet have all those holes in it? That's from when you scratched out the spot so hard you put a hole in the paper.
Yeah.
But now Lyle and I were talking about this at work, and sitting there turn after turn, rolling a d20, hoping for a 10+, while all the other players are doing something, is not fun. So, not that I'm disappointed to see that in there, just this again. So, I don't know, I think 13th Age did a kind of a better job where if you were out, you could still do that fighting in spirit thing. Because honestly, what player wants to sit there making death checks turn after turn while everyone else has fun?
That's not necessarily the way it's going to be. I mean, other games and previous iterations of this, when you reach 0, you just died, period. And
you
sit
what?
There for the rest of the session.
Fine.
But that's
you can
that's
spend the
case,
rest of the session rolling up a new character.
Or you can take control of an NPC or something like that. It doesn't mean that you have to just sit there silently.
It doesn't my game. No, you are dead. Sit there. Roll that die. Don't do anything else.
Go behind the curtain.
Yeah.
No, and this leads into another thing about how you heal. Well, they have something similar to like a healing surge using your hit dice, which I like in the sense that the hit dice is doing something other than just rolling hit points.
Yes, I agree.
And I did like that because I can remember from being an early gamer, like there's a lot of terms and sometimes they keep terms, but you don't know why they don't just call it something else because it doesn't come up that often.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it was like hit dice. Why don't you just call the monster a level and just give it a number of hit points? And
You could if you were playing Numenera.
Yeah. And I know it came up occasionally in things and like turning undead, the hit dice factored
sleep.
In. But but I like that hit dice plays even more roles within this game.
Mm-hmm. Right. This kind of struck me as being 4E-esque, where...
Oh, it is. It's the healing. It's their version of the healing surge.
Right, the Wolverine factor. However, you can't do it, at least under normal circumstances. Who knows what's going to come out later. You can't do it during combat. To use your hit dice, you have to rest for about an hour, and then you can spend as many hit dice as you want, and then you roll them all, add your constitution modifier to each die, and you regain that many hit points. Then when you take a long rest, which is, you know, the 8-hour rest, then you heal all your hit points, but you only get half of your maximum hit dice back, which I was kind of glad to see, rather than you just going completely up to full strength, Wolverine style.
Yeah, except for fighters. They can wolf out.
Yes, as I said, yeah. There are a couple things that allow you to regain hit points outside of a short rest, but... Yeah. Generally, I'm fine with it. And as Lyle said, it's nice to see the name Hit Die actually referring to a die and kind of having it matter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, when you have a hit point game and a hit point system, you need to make it so people can heal easily. Or people are just going to stop and the game is just going to grind to a halt and maybe go back out of the dungeon and wait until they're all healed up or down healing potions.
Yep, the 5-minute workday.
Yeah. Because, like, right outside the dungeon is all these little potion vials, as if there was, like, some sort of, like, bush party.
Or you're outside a crack den. What are those healing vials?
Man, this is one tough dungeon.
Yeah.
It's funny, the references that we use. Canadian using bush party and crack addict using crack vials.
Hey, who said I'm a crack addict?
Sorry, recovering addict.
All right. But now we were joking earlier about how a person or a character who's knocked to 0 hit points, falls unconscious. And I was looking through the rules to see if it said if they could still take actions, because the long rest says that you have to have at least 1 hit point to benefit from the long rest, while a short rest doesn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
So at first there was a bit of ambiguity as to whether you could just, make a healing surge while you were at 0 hit points. Turns out you can't, because if you go unconscious, you're also incapacitated, and if you're incapacitated, you can't take actions. Now.
Yep.
All right.
I don't know if it is not clear with the short rest, like you said, but... It might be implied because it's saying that they're doing nothing more strenuous than eating, drinking, reading, or tending to wounds. It seems to imply that the person is conscious.
Right.
When they're taking a short rest. If they're unconscious and they've been unconscious for 2 hours, you can't designate the 3rd hour as a short rest.
Right. No, yeah. I gotcha. No. Fictionally, it of course doesn't make sense, but...
Yeah, he stopped shaking. Oh yeah, he's taking a short rest right now. Oh good, because then he'll move into the long rest and he might be able to wake up.
Right.
Yeah. So it sounds like if they're unconscious, then they don't go into a rest. And maybe that's what they should say.
Go into a coma.
Yeah. Well, that was another minor criticism I had about the book, is there's a few places where the wording is a bit unclear. I think there's one line that I saw way at the beginning that was, what was it? No attack roll has advantage against you while you aren't incapacitated.
Yeah, that was a bit, I saw that too. That was a bit weird.
Heck?
Yeah.
It just would have been much better. As long as you aren't incapacitated, you no attack can be rolled with advantage against you or something
like that. Right, right. Or the wording where if you are hidden, it says, instead of saying you reveal yourself when you make an attack, It says, mm-hmm. you reveal yourself when your attack roll hits or misses. And I'm like, well, what's the third option there?
Right. I'm going to disagree. I disagree on that one.
Okay.
Because I think people.
Just to be contrary.
No, because I think people would actually go, well, what happens if it misses? And you'd be like, ugh.
Yeah, but my thing is, like, couldn't the wording have been, regardless of whether your attack hits or misses, you reveal yourself?
Yeah. I don't want to make it sound like a big deal. It's a first printing, so.
Oh, all right.
All right. No, I'm being contrary. Sorry.
Well, I was talking about wording, and we're picking nits. I guess the attack of opportunity one is the way it was written. To me, it sounded like they didn't really want attacks of opportunity to be taken on the characters. It's more presenting as it, hey, here's when you can do attacks of opportunity to intercept people trying to walk by you.
Oh, are you talking about disengage, the disengage action?
Sorry, attacks of opportunity attacks. So you it says you can make an opportunity attack when a hostile creature moves out of your reach. And it talks about what happens with when a creature moves by you, but then in the next paragraph it says you can avoid provoking an opportunity attack by taking the disengage action.
Right, I see.
And you also don't provoke an opportunity attack when you tell it. It's as if you got to be really dumb to get an opportunity attack against mm-hmm. you.
Right, so I see. Yeah, it's kind of their use of creature or enemy creature when describing
hostile creature. Players or hostile creatures provoke opportunity attacks when they move out of reach. It's you can make one.
When a creature moves out
of
reach.
Yeah, and by the way, hey, you can avoid it by doing all of these things.
Right.
Like, don't
I see what you're saying.
These things.
Yeah.
So it might be very deliberate wording here, and it just seems to imply like this is being presented more as something for you to have fun with to do on hostile creatures as opposed to get hit by.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you can just disengage. Hey, dude. Just disengage.
Yeah.
But now you bring up disengage. It looks like the disengage action is kind of encouraging what we normally see in a D&D fight where two combatants just run up, stand next to each other, and start wailing on each other, and nobody moves.
Right.
Because to use the disengage action, you have to use your one action. And then for the rest of your turn, your movement doesn't provoke opportunity attacks, but you don't get to attack. So if you're relying on doing damage to whatever you're fighting, why would you bother to move if you're not going to get to attack? So,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that that's new or that's bad. I mean, because in my experience, D&D has always kind of been those static fights where, you know, you just run and hit people in the middle and then just, you don't really move until one of you is dead and then you go target the next guy.
I don't want to say it's static, but perhaps it's a little like chess.
Hmm.
So you position yourself. And maybe this even gets back to the wording with opportunity attacks. It's like, hey, here's how you can set things up where you can protect the softer guy behind you.
Right. Right.
Yeah. But. So, well, and the other, the big thing in gameplay, of course, a classic, it clocks in at 78th page of a 102-page document, and this is where fighters and rogues can really stop reading this document. And that is the rules of magic. And hey, Vancian magic is back with a vengeance, and it is very recognizable from previous editions.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a difference we were discussing before the cast, because now there's magic is actually a little bit more complicated than those of us who are used to like 3E or 2E. I would say.
But at the same time, more flexible, and I think necessarily so.
Yeah, fair enough.
I'd say more flexible. Is it necessarily more complicated? I don't know, because, well, we'll just explain it. I mean, they have spell slots, but there's also the spells that you know as a wizard.
Well, there's the spells you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's the spells you can prepare at the start of the day.
Right.
And then there's spell slots.
Okay, when I meant... No, I meant the ones that you've prepared.
Right, okay. Okay.
Yeah, for the day. But that's a bit of distinction, what you just said.
Right, where third edition, prior, I think you only had spells you know and spell slots per day. And you just kind of filled the slots with what spell you were going to prepare, you know, when you prepared spells. And now it's, I know a sort of large number of spells. I can prepare a smaller subset of those spells. And I don't have to designate what spell slot they're filling. I can kind of use my spell slots however I want. So
If you know Magic Missile, in previous editions you would have to remember Magic Missile several times, filling up several of your slots if you wanted to cast it several times per day. However, now you can prepare Magic Missile as one spell and then use all of your spell slots during the day to cast that one over and over if you prefer.
If you wanted to, yeah. Which, you bring that up, Chris, it's not in the basic D&D, but I wonder what then the Sorcerer or possibly the Warlock will look like, since clerics and wizards can now kind of, and within certain parameters, cast spells on the fly.
Yeah, and they did that with fighters too. You, as a fighter now, you can specialize in two-weapon fighting or in archery. So I'm wondering, what are they going to do with the ranger?
I see the analogy now, but I was about to say, well, they don't get to decide that at the start of every fight.
Oh, right, yeah.
Right. Oh, and you guys have said it seems more like a sorcerer, but it's giving people more options, and then they can make those choices. Giving them more options and more decision points, which are always good in the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they got it at the beginning of the day when, oh, I'm studying, I'll study these ones, and I'll know these for the day. Right. And then each turn, they got to, which one am I going to use? Now, I don't know how exciting this is going to be for the guy who's making his death saves, or the fighter who's waiting for the wizard to go, which one will I choose? But it sounds like it would be very fun to play.
I wonder if some of the feedback they got was, we don't like locking in wizard spells at the beginning of the day, because unless you choose correctly, unless you anticipate what challenges you will face for that adventuring day, your spells could be completely useless.
Oh, I'm sure it's feedback, but also from their own experience, players. As players, when you go into a dungeon, you're like, oh, it's underwater.
Right. Oh, why did I choose levitate?
Okay, can we come back tomorrow? Because I'm going to be like totally ready then. And they were just, how about... And a lot of dungeon masters would just go, just change it then.
Right.
Yeah,
just change
it. So they
were
just... I mean, but they've got to lock down some rules that provide... You know, they got to lock in the flexibility, both because they have like standardized or they've got organized events.
Right.
And also because you are going to get the game master goes, well, no, play what you wrote down.
What you wrote down. The people who say, or the DMs who say, play what you wrote down are probably going to be like, yeah, okay, you can come back tomorrow, and then secretly changes everything to, now it's a fire dungeon.
The water's evaporated.
Yeah.
It's acid now.
We lose so many players.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like that. And then when you get into the spells, I mean, you still got the... As you would expect, the casting time, you have your range, you have your components, and your duration. We were talking before, the cast is as... I'm sure there you can... Well, you can always say there's two kinds of people, or there's two kinds of players, and those that use components and those that don't. And we are definitely in the we don't use components camp.
Oh, yeah.
But I think this is... It's harmless to put in for the people that want it, and... And if you're somebody who doesn't use components, we've been ignoring it for so long that we can just keep pushing on for another edition.
Right.
Yeah. They give a lot of nice options for it. I like the way that they did it in 4E, where they just kind of say, here's your component costs and spend this much value of that cost. And here they kind of give you all of the different options. You can either use the components as they're written. You can just have a component sack that magically contains whatever components you need, or you have a magical focus that can take the place of a component. Right. So really, you just choose however you want to play it.
Yeah. With that said, I mean, somebody who comes up and writes in all the components, I think they've done a good job for the materials.
Yeah.
They're pretty, pretty clever components, but who wants to count out strips of white cloth and powdered iron? Some people, and that's great.
The components were always cool, but unfortunately, since usually only one or two players would have to do it, because you only had one or two spellcasters, unfortunately, they just bogged the game down for very little return. When the people don't have the components, and then the wizard says, great, I got to go shopping for components, and everyone else at the table rolls their eyes, because they're not going to have anything else to do. Or when the wizard says, oh, great, I'm going to start collecting, you know, these mushrooms or this whatever, and all the other players are like, well, why? And he's like, well, I'm going to need my components, you know. That's what I mean. Like,
Gonna skin these bats.
Yeah, exactly. Skin these bats. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
I need some
yeah.
newts. Need to take out their eyes.
Yeah. So
no. Let's get some bones. I mean, mark them.
You could have real fun with that if you were playing like I don't know like an all wizard campaign, right?
Where so that's more even more shopping.
Well, no.
It's
then
like a
you,
day,
then you,
and we can get cafe latte.
Could I finish my point? Hey, is the cafe latte part of the components? Maybe I don't know. No, my point is like, if you cast like a or if you want to cast a big spell, then you can wrap a quest around it, you know, or you do something where it's in getting these components is interesting, but that would kind of only work if everybody was wizards and if everybody wanted to do that.
Hey,
you
man,
know?
You got any bat guano? I need a ball of sulfur.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll trade you.
Yeah, think about it. You open up the chest, and it's not gold. It's a chest full of bat drop. Everyone's like, yeah.
Only one person's like...
Wizard starts dancing.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, who's going to help me carry this, guys? Guys, I can't carry this.
Yeah, why don't you, like, you know, unseen servant that card out of here?
I would say of all the pedantic rules that there are in Dungeons and Dragons, this is probably the one that could be the most fun. I mean, weight isn't, you know, oh, that's too heavy. What are you going to leave behind? Oh, I really? Yeah. you must be tired now because you're carrying so much weight. And you're like, ah, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to leave the dungeon now. Oh, wait.
Yeah, yeah come
Here's
back.
Here's a bag
come
of holding.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this is, I mean, you're throwing crystal balls on the ground. I mean, that's pretty cool. Yeah, I just never got into that.
Well, hopefully they do something other than just roll around. But
yeah, you don't know what.
Why would you just smash that, man? That's worth a lot
of
money.
No, think about it.
Why are you throwing
crystal balls on the ground? Well, you know, all this glass will, you know, make it difficult for someone.
Now I'm going to throw the bat droppings and the feet are going to get infected.
Yeah. Like, oh, are you casting a spell? No, poor man's caltrops.
Yeah, have some iron filings in your eyes. Take that, you fairy.
You know what?
I'm not actually even a wizard. I just have lots of crap.
Yeah, you know what? I kind of want to play that character now. I'm not a wizard. I just have all this crap I throw at you.
Yeah, you'd be a pretty cool rogue. Yeah. A rogue masquerading as a wizard.
Yep.
There you go.
This is a wizard. Why else would he have bat droppings?
Right.
Here's one. For Dream, a handful of sand, a dab of ink, and a writing quill plucked from a sleeping bird. Yeah. How about the game master? Well, he wasn't sleeping. He was pretending to sleep. Ah, it doesn't work. So spellcasting is the same. So I think anybody who's a fan of classic D&D spellcasting, I think is going to like this and maybe like it a little bit more than previous editions, although we keep breaking our, we're not really comparing this to previous editions. Yeah. Just because I really do like the addition of the choices that the wizard has. Mm-hmm. I think it makes that class a little bit more fun to play.
Yeah.
And they have things like where you can scale up. I mean, when they're talking about the taking up a slot, so some of the spells will say at higher levels, and it tells you what it does. So that's pretty neat.
Right. Because I'm sure one of the complaints they got was certain spells are useless once you get to higher levels. And now they're saying, nope, spells are going to be, you know, useful for longer because you can elect to cast them or at a higher spell slot. So
yeah, and they also have ritual. Certain spells are tagged with the ritual name, and that just means you can spend a little bit longer preparing them, and it won't take up a spell slot.
I only counted 8 spells that had the ritual descriptor, so
it seems like an afterthought.
But it just doesn't seem all that good.
Well, they had the rituals in 4E. I kind of liked how they did that, but...
Man, somebody loves this 4E.
Yeah, really. Why did you stop running it again?
Because I didn't like it.
You don't say. Could have fooled me by this podcast.
I mean, I think some spells lend themselves to rituals more than others. I mean, a ritual fireball, could you do that? Sure.
Yeah.
But what are you going to do? Like, spend 10 minutes to make a fireball? And
yeah, sure. And then just blow
it.
Blow.
I can make infinite fireballs? Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Then just like blow a hole through the dungeon wall and say, screw your door, Game Master. We're going
this
way.
Yeah, I guess if you're doing artillery, or I don't know, like, what's the point? But rituals, I like the addition of rituals because it harkens back to real sword and sorcery where, you know, the wizard or the sorcerer would be spending all this time making one spell.
Right.
and putting in the components, and it takes days to do the spell. So right. it's nice to do that, but if at the end of it, it's a fireball, you're like, oh, and you just light some torches or whatever. I mean, what was he doing with that fireball?
I kind of see your point.
In 3 days, a giant will appear right there, so I'm going to get this ready.
Right. Yeah. Now, that when you put it that way, that's a good point. Like, the effects probably are not worth the... Not worth the amount of time, but, you know, you putting it that way. Yeah, in Sword and Sorcery, you did cast a big old ritual, and it did something really freaking cool, other than just summon a fireball, or, do chain lightning, or whatever.
Although, like, Earthquake or Dream, not rituals. And maybe mechanically, there's nothing within the game that makes it worth doing it as a ritual.
Right.
But... I can see somebody spending a lot of time creating an earthquake.
Hmm.
Or, I mean, we've all seen Inception or, oh, what was it called? Dreamscape with Dennis Quaid. Anyway, another dream movie.
Yep, yeah, I'll take your word for it, yeah.
Where you can imagine somebody setting that up. You know, I'm going to invade this person's dream, or I'm going to create illusion in this person's dream. I'm going to need to draw like a circle and sleep in it. And pep salt. I don't know. Yeah. Clearly, I'm not a.
Well, we know who plays the thief.
The occultist. You're just sleeping, aren't you? No. I'm doing a ritual.
See the ring of Epsom salt around me?
Ten more minutes.
Oh, you knocked it over when you were walking in. Guess I got to sleep again.
So yeah, I'm surprised to not see. Ritual for certain spells, but mechanically it probably is not needed, but stylistically, yeah, that's be pretty neat to have a ritual. All right, well, what about style? What did you think of that? And we've already said it doesn't have any pictures, but on the other hand, it's free.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty much what you'd expect for a fantasy role-playing book. It's on kind of a parchment background. It's got your basic tables. So there's not really much fanciness to it, but it's well laid out, nice. Everything is put in sections.
Yeah, you're right. The kind of parchment background is reminiscent of 3E, while the footer details, right, kind of the spiky swoops at the bottom, kind of reminded me of 4E a little bit. So I think they're really trying to, you know, kind of take all the style of all the editions and kind of put them together in one package so that everybody can look at it and see something from an edition that they liked.
I'm never going to tell you what my thoughts on prior to an episode because I just hear them back.
Hey, I said exactly the same thing before you did at lunch. Not my fault you had the same idea.
I think I said it first. Anyway.
I don't think you did. I think you're remembering incorrectly, sir.
I agree with myself agreeing with Wayne.
All right.
I don't know. Yeah, no, I agree with Wayne in that I think the designers of this game deserve as much credit, if not more credit, for uniting the editions and giving something that literally looks like D&D. I think it looks great. I had certain quibbles about where things were placed, such as when you're rolling your stats, they do the traditional roll 4 dice, choose the best 3, or then choose these numbers, and then they mentioned, oh, you can also like customize your ability scores through a point buy, and that's on page 7. And then on the page 9 is where you actually see the ability score point cost in the section called choose equipment. So, a minor quibble there, but it wasn't flawlessly laid out, I guess.
Right.
Yeah, it's PDF. It's bookmarked. Doesn't have links or layers, but you know, again, free. So
right.
Yeah.
No, the bookmarks were nice. Yeah, it's free. Pictures would have been nice, but it's not that the text is illegible. They did the two columns, which is much easier.
By any means.
Yep, much easier on the eyes to read, but it's still a brick of text.
But I was surprised when I opened it up and I said, hey, it's not black and white. Like, looks like something done on Word. No, it's, I think we can expect to see something similar to this in the Player's Handbook.
I think so. I think this is probably the same thing you're going to see in the Player's Handbook with an addition of pictures.
Yeah. Well, something that relates to style is how they've embedded flavor text, into, for example, introducing races. Mm. So they'll take something from Icewind Dale.
right.
and put that in and introduces that. I know that's gotten a lot of positive feedback, and certainly when I've seen it in other games and the way they've done it, I think it really adds something to the game.
Right.
And it seems like Forgotten Realms is definitely the default, which made me a little bit curious why they made certain choices.
Hmm.
So I think with the humans, they walk through all these names that you can get from different parts of the Forgotten Realms. But then when we get into the different dwarf sub-races, you've got the hill dwarf and the mountain dwarfs, but then it says gold... Sorry, they call them gold dwarves and shield dwarves in Forgotten Realms. And right. So I'm wondering why they went with a kind of a Greyhawk naming there, but and not the Forgotten Realms naming?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just to highlight... and they mentioned this in the beginning that, hey, you know, there are a bunch of different worlds in D&D, and we're going to give you some of them here, but not all of them, and, you know, you can make up your own. So maybe they did it to pull in a mix of different things rather than just being completely from the Forgotten Realms, despite that being the default setting for 5th edition.
No, I get what you mean, I might be making too big a deal of this, is that why not just call it a gold dwarf and then say, hey, they're called hill dwarves here, or they're called
whatever
Clar of Kryn in the Dragonlance setting.
That's a good point. I don't know, but as far as the bits of fiction at the beginning of the sections, they didn't really do anything for me, because I'm not really that familiar with the fiction for D&D in terms of like novels or whatever, but I can see people who have enjoyed the novels and do like the fiction saying, oh yeah, I remember that scene or I remember that character and that was awesome. So I think they were pretty smart to do that, because it excites the people who know about it, while the people who don't know about it will just think of it as a nice bit of flavor text.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it gives credit to the people that have helped shape their game.
Right.
And saying, hey, these are the elves. And you know something, when we think of elves and Dungeons and Dragons, yeah, we think more than Tolkien. Hey, because of what Margaret Rice and Tracy Hickman did.
Right.
Here's something from Dragons of Autumn, Twilight. And no, that's not vampires.
Yeah.
Not funny.
I was just about to say, I would have been more excited if it was.
So do you think the new D&D is a success? And yes, you can define what success means for you. I think it is, and in the sense that if they want a game that has drawn good elements from previous editions and has a good chance of bringing together as many people as they can, then yeah, this is a success. You know, I think after all the hype of the playtesting, and that they were going to listen to people and put in their feedback. I mean, if people open up there's probably something for everybody. Like, yeah, that's what I wanted from that edition.
Yeah, I totally agree. In fact, in the same way, I think their goal was to kind of marry all of the various editions together. And I think they've got a good game that still feels like D&D, but it also touches all of the other editions. I think there's a lot of really small tweaks all over the place that I really like. I mean, even down to, as I was mentioning before, just the inclusion of little pieces of equipment. It's really, really small, but I think it really makes the game more flavorful and full. So, I think it is still D&D, and it might be one of the best versions of D&D I've seen yet.
Yeah, I too would agree that it's a success, mainly for the same reasons that both of you guys said. It feels like D&D, which I think is what a lot of people had a problem with for 4E, as I mentioned in the beginning. And it does a nice job of pulling all the different elements from different editions to the point where it's, you know, nothing is probably identical to the edition it's pulled from, but if you liked something from earlier editions, while reading through this one, you can like, oh, okay, I kind of see where that came from, or, you know, I know where that came from, or, oh, this thing is similar to the mechanic or the you know, bit of fiction that I liked from a previous edition, and while it's not identical, it's similar enough to where I know how to play this game. And mm-hmm. I think that is what Wizards of the Coast was going for. They were going for something or an edition where anyone who has played any of the other editions of D&D would be able to read this document and say, I pretty much already know how to play. Maybe there's little differences here and there, but yeah. What you've given me, I'm already familiar with because I was familiar with what came before.
So
I think that's a good point. Like, you could come from any edition, any single edition,
right?
And you won't be bewildered.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you got somebody who's locked into first edition and or second edition, and they don't want to go to this edition, then it's just time to give up on them. Because I'm not sure what would please them other than the same game that they're already playing. They seem to be pretty happy with first or second edition.
Right.
Yeah. Whether or not third edition people, because I think a lot of them get up now play Pathfinder, whether they'll come back, I don't know. It might not even come down to the rules and what's presented. It's just the fact that they might feel very positively towards Paizo.
Right.
So they might want to continue to support them. But I think a lot of Pathfinder players also play D&D and vice, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure there's the people who, you know, went over to Pathfinder because they didn't like 4E. And let's be honest, there's probably everybody who jumped over to Pathfinder. But yeah, I'm sure a subset of those people now have a brand loyalty to Paizo. And it wouldn't really matter what Wizards of the Coast put out. They're kind of, you know, they're going to stick with Paizo, where other people will be happy to go back. So I think that's what Wizards of the Coast was, part of what they were going for with this. Mm-hmm.
So, any predictions, since we are talking about Pathfinder, what do you think are going to be the reactions from other companies? I think Pathfinder is going to release a new edition soonish,
I agree.
It will be a simplified version of their current game. So it'll be a simplified version of 3.75.
Right, right. No, I think that's what they're going to do. I remember opening up the revised second edition books, which were kind of the first D&D books I started with, and the first front page says, this is not D&D 3rd edition. It's just a cleaning up and kind of a fixing of the second edition rules, and I think that's what Pathfinder is going to do, because now they have so much supplemental material, they're probably going to say, okay, it's kind of time to reset, but not call it Pathfinder 2. We're going to, you know, call it, you know, Pathfinder Revised or Pathfinder whatever, and they're going to kind of scale back and, you know, incorporate the things that they thought were positive about all the supplemental material they put out while dropping things they felt didn't work or nobody uses, and just kind of scale back to make it a bit more accessible and streamlined.
They need it too. It was this a bewildering amount of content in Pathfinder.
There's a reason it's called Mathfinder.
It's so true.
Yeah. I think they'll emphasize backwards compatibility.
Mm-hmm.
With the other fantasy games out there, they seem to be very like narrative, like Dungeon World, tied to something, to a particular license, like A Song of Ice and Fire role-playing. So
right.
I don't think... And hey, that's nice to see the writers on here and Robert J. Schwab, who wrote A Song of Ice and Fire role-playing,
mm-hmm.
is credited as one of the writers. So this is great because he made one great game, and it's nice to see his contributions to this game.
I wonder if 13th Age will get a boost, because there are still people who are big fans of 4E.
Well, we did say when we talked about 13th Age and we gave 13th Age a positive review, is that we could see people's, we'll call them the core fantasy players. We'll call them, or the D&D players, and they will split between Pathfinder, 13th Age, and D&D. Yeah, 13th Age is a solid product. It's written, in a very likable way, like you want to like the people that wrote it.
Mm.
It's very folksy. Yeah, and it's definitely got its own style, so I think it'll have its own niche.
No, I agree.
It won't be in the top two as far as sales or presence.
I think this is a case of a rising tide floats all boats, you know? D&D does well, then that probably means a lot of other companies will do well.
Yeah, and I think that gets into another prediction that we have, and I think we might start seeing stuff specifically geared, and perhaps even free stuff, specifically geared towards brand new players. So as we said in the beginning of the episode, we didn't think that the basic rules was terribly appropriate for a brand new player. It's a bit heavy, a little picture light. So I think we're going to see free products or more free products targeting new players. In fact, we'll be doing one and posting it up. So it just kind of our vision of something that we think would be really appropriate or really good to give to a new player.
Right.
And it gets back to, like, we were talking about the starter set, which I think is priced really well. And sales are going through the roof, and I bet you sales are going through the roof because people can't wait until the Player's Handbook comes out next month.
Right. Mm. You said something really interesting where it would be more telling to see what the sales of the starter set look like after those three books have come out.
Yeah, I think that they're going to sell really well this year, and then it'll be interesting to see how well they sell next year after people now go into the store, and then they see the Player's Handbook, Dungeon Master's Guide, and Monster Manual there.
Right.
And whether they go, well, that's a really attractive price, but should I just spend the extra $30 and get the Player's Handbook?
Right, right.
Not that that's appropriate for a new player. I mean, of course, if they can get that stocked in Toys R Us or Walmart and Target, then that might help the starter set.
Oh, yeah, hugely.
Move, but I don't know. And it's the thing is, like, people do have a firm belief. I mean, we did that survey. People really believe in the idea of the starter set, but I suspect people who started on the starter set back in the early 80s believe in the power of the introductory box set. But whether or not it still has that power, I don't know. And maybe more free downloads might be the way to go to reach people. Because it's all about networks. The best way to learn a game like this is the dungeon, some experienced players taking you on and teaching you. Now, I doubt they're going to buy a starter set for you and hand it to you and say, you know, here you go.
Meet up, see you next week.
Yeah. Or they'll have the starter set and they'll stop their campaign and go, okay, now we're going to play the starter game, for Stacy so that she can learn the game. And everybody's like, oh, okay, that's great. But, I mean, time is so precious. Do people want to go back to level one?
Right.
Or do people want to play the adventure that they've played three times already? So we might see other ways in which to get players up to speed or new people up to speed or to entice new people. Mm-hmm. So that ends our episode on D&D Basics. Overall, we think it's a success. And we also have reviews of similar games such as Savage Worlds, Numenera, and 13th Age on our website. So check those out to see what we thought of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and hopefully it's a success by Hasbro's definition as well, i.e. lots of sales.
Right.
So then we get more D&D.
Yep.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time. Bye.
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 I don't know if I would say it's the best version of D&D, but it's you know,
okay,
certainly I don't know. Like I don't know. But let me do that section over, because yeah, that was pretty negative and I don't have a follow up for that. Okay.
Yeah,
sorry.
Remember, and you're gonna choose which one is the best too.
We're doing the put up or shut up.
Right.
Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Oh, Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.